Hello, welcome to our first year in a series on the history of halachic responsa in America, in the Americas, and later on focused more so on the United States. The objective in this year, in terms of what we're going to cover, is first and foremost responsa, shalos and tshuvos that reflect various important historical events or time periods in the history of Jews in the broader American scene. The second type of responsa that we'll look at are responsas, again, shalos and tshuvos that were just monumental, that are very important. Shalos and tshuvos that were issued by rabbis either in the United States in America or to congregations and people in America. And the third type of responsa that we'll look at are just, responsa that stand out as just particularly interesting in the American context. So, the first tshuva that we're going to look at is actually, believe it or not, is the first tshuva that was sent to the Americas. We're going back to the mid-17th century for this one, so quite a bit. And this is, in fact, the first recorded tshuva that was sent to any person or any congregation in the Americas. We'll give a lot of background to the tshuva in terms of the congregation that it was sent to, in terms of some of the personalities that are involved, and here we go. So the first tshuva sent to the Americas was by Rabbi Chaim Shabtai of Salonika in Greece. He is, in fact, the first meshiv, right, the first rabbi who sends this responsum to, in this case, a congregation in Brazil. We'll talk about that congregation quite at length. And the tshuva, it's hard to date exactly, but we think, and we'll talk about soon in a few minutes, how we get to that. But the tshuva seems to be from approximately 1635 to 1637, one of those years. So let's go in terms of the background to this tshuva. The tshuva is sent to the Jewish community in Recife, Brazil, and the background to the founding of that community. Some of you may be familiar with it, some more, some less. But we'll give a little bit of a background to that. So the community is founded in the 1620s or so. How did that come about? So let's go back approximately 130 or 40 years before that. We know that the Jews are expelled from Spain in 1492. We're all familiar with that date. The Jews were expelled from Portugal, neighboring Portugal, in 1497. So what happened in 1497 is that many Jews, much like, it's kind of a replica, if you will, in a way, of what took place in neighboring Spain, many Jews in Portugal were either forcibly converted at that point in 1497, forcibly converted to Catholicism, or some of them voluntarily converted to Catholicism. But in either case, we do know that many of them continue living, excuse me, to differing degrees as Jews. This is, of course, the advent of the Converso community in Portugal. Converso, Marano, New Christian. There are many different terms for these Jews, depending on which perspective you take, but many of them continued living to differing degrees, again, some more so, some less, as Jews. they became known, as we just mentioned, a few of the terms that are used to define or to call these Jews. So one of them was New Christians, and that was really the Catholic term for these Jews. And if you look throughout the through the literature, you'll basically see two terms. One is converso, and one is New Christian. The term Marano is a little bit less, I don't know, formal or less professional. Actually, has more of a derogatory connotation to it, but to Christians they were called New Christians, and the reason they were called New Christians is, well, for obvious reasons, is that they were new, but they were also they were suspected in many cases, not obviously in any case justifying the Inquisition, but from the Catholic perspective, they were suspected of hiding their Judaism and of continuing to practice their Judaism, which was true in many cases. Again, like we said, different people and different families to differing degrees. Now, many of these new Christians, i.e. converso Jews, came to the Portuguese colony in Brazil. Brazil is obviously a vast, vast land, a vast country, so the Portuguese did not control the entirety of it, but the part that the Portuguese did control, many Portuguese came to inhabit that and to work in the local economies, and many new Christians, these converso Jews, came along with them. Now, in 1624 becomes a critical year for the history of, well, the background to this tshuva and the history of the Jews in that part of the world. Why is that? So in 1624, the Dutch took over a portion of the Portuguese colony of Brazil, and that portion of the colony, and you'll have to excuse my pronunciation here. I think I'm getting it correct, but is called till this day Pernambuco. Pernambuco is in northeastern Brazil. If you look at a map, and the main city in Pernambuco, I believe till this day, is still Recife. So Recife, which is on the Brazilian coast, is the main city in this Pernambuco, in this portion of northeastern Brazil, and that portion is taken over by the Dutch in 1624. So why is it so important? So the reason this is so important is because, as opposed to the Portuguese, who were intolerant, who enforced the Inquisition, who hunted down new Christians, the Dutch, in complete contrast to that, were tolerant. We know that the Dutch in Holland itself were very tolerant, not just of Jews, but of many different religions. The Dutch were very focused on mercantilism. They were very focused on their economy, and for that and for other reasons, which we won't go into, which are beyond the purview of this, but they welcomed the people of different backgrounds, of different faiths, etc. So the Dutch were actually much more tolerant, and they were tolerant of Jews. And so what happened in Pernambuco, particularly in Recife, we'll refer more so to just to Recife, what happened in Recife is many of these new Christians who had come to Brazil hiding their Judaism under control of the Portuguese, now once the Dutch took over, these new Christians were able to come out. They were able to profess their Judaism publicly. They were able to practice their Judaism publicly and openly. So that's in 1624. What happened subsequent to that is that many Dutch Jews from the motherland, if you will, from Holland itself, particularly from the thriving Jewish community in Amsterdam, they come to Brazil also. Why do they come? Well, why do Jews always come to America, right? So the Golden Medina. We know that that America, later on the United States, became known as this in the with the Yiddishism, right? Is the Golden Land, the land of economic opportunity, and that's why many Dutch Jews came from Holland to Brazil seeking economic opportunity. In 1636 is also an important year. 1636 is when the first congregation in the Americas is founded, Kahal Kadosh Tzur Yisrael, it was known. It was a Portuguese, Sephardic a congregation. If I'm not mistaken, it was kind of rebuilt or reconstituted to some degree. I don't know exactly within the last few years, just. But 1636 is when this first congregation, Tzur Yisrael, is founded in Recife. Now, let's fast forward just a few years. In 1642, so approximately 6 years after the founding of the congregation, right, of this first shul or congregation, however we want to, more than just a shul, it was a community. And 6 years after that, the first rabbis are sent from Amsterdam to Recife. So there's a six-year gap between the founding of this shul, of this congregation, and the arrival of these rabbis. Okay, so 6 years without rabbis, that might be for some people a dream come true. But in any case, in 1642, the first rabbis arrive. And again, everything that we're mentioning, the first this and the first that, they really are. These are monumental events. It was the first congregation started in the Americas. And so in 1642, those 6 years later, when these rabbis arrived, they are the first rabbis to come and to serve in the Americas. Who were they? We can talk about them for a long time. They're fascinating and important individuals, but that's actually not going to be the focus of this year. But just to name them, one was Rav Yitzchak Abohav da Fonseca, was a very prominent rabbi before his arrival in Brazil. He was prominent in Amsterdam, and when he went back to Amsterdam later on, he became even more prominent. And the second one was also an important rabbi, was Rabbi Moshe Aguilar. So these two rabbis come to serve the congregation, the Portuguese Sephardi congregation in Recife. Okay, so the fact that there is this six-year gap between the founding of the congregation and the arrival of the rabbis is very important for the dating of this tshuva and the background to this tshuva, because the tshuva was sent from Brazil overseas. Now, had there been rabbis already in Recife at the time, presumably, not every local rabbi we know is able to answer every question, but presumably, either of these rabbis, Rav Yitzchak Avohav or Rav Moshe Aguilar, would have been able to, at least to some degree, to address the question that was asked. But they weren't there. So the congregation in Recife sent the tshuva overseas. Now, how do we know how to date this tshuva? So for this, I do have to mention this wonderful book, small set of Svarim, of books that were printed in the past, came out in the past, well, the first two, I believe, came out about 15 years ago, if not mistaken, and the third volume actually recently came out, but there's a wonderful set of books called Kisvei Rabbeinu Yitzchak Abohav, so this the same Rabbi Yitzchak Abohav that I just mentioned, and the subtitle is Chachmei Recife v'Amsterdam. So it brings, it's essentially a collection of the writings of Rav Yitzchak Avohav from his time in Recife, as well as, and mostly from his time in Amsterdam, but also from his time in Recife. It was published and really gathered, and the scholarship here was done by Rabbi Yosef Weitman, who is a Chabad rabbi in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and he really took it upon himself to research some of the history of the community in Brazil. Again, he's not in Recife, he's in Sao Paulo, but the history of the Jews in Brazil and the rabbis in Brazil in at this time, and particularly Rabbi Yitzchak Avohav. So this tshuva, even though it's not written by Rabbi Yitzchak Avohav, is printed in this set of really, really interesting and wonderful svarim. So that's my plug, or that my recommendation for that. So, why am I mentioning that here, aside from to give Rav Weitman credit for all his work? But he writes here in a footnote on the I think it's yeah here the first footnote on this tshuva, he thinks that he's able to date it to these that span of 1635 to 1637. How so? So like this, Rav Chaim Shabtai of Salonika, who is the author of the Tshuva, writes in his answer from the community of Brazil. Again, we'll get to the substance of the Shiloh and the Tshuva, of the question and the answer soon. But he writes in the beginning of his answer to the Shiloh, he writes that he's there in Salonika, right, in this very, very important and prominent community in Greece. And anyone who knows anything about the community in Salonika, one of, if not the main, economic activity that they were involved in for a long period of time is that they actually produced uniforms for the Ottoman army. They produced uniforms for the Ottoman army. That was one of, if not the main economic activity of the Salonikan Jewish community. And so he writes there that during that he wasn't able to, just Rav Chaim Shabtai, the Rav in Salonika, he writes that he wasn't able to answer the question, the inquiry, right away from the community in Brazil. Why? Because this heavy taxation and these burdens that the Ottoman ruler has placed on the community in Salonika. So Rav Weitman, again, the rabbi in Sao Paulo, did the research on this. Well, he dates those particular taxes, taxation, and those economic burdens that were placed on the Salonikan community to those years, 1635 to 1637 or so, which would give us the date, again, the approximate date of when this tshuva was sent from Salonika back to Brazil. Okay, so again, it's sent overseas, knowing that there was no rabbinic presence in Brazil itself that would have been able to address this question. Now, very briefly, who was? We're not going to go into this, although obviously an important topic in and of itself. Who was this Rav Chaim Shabtai of Salonika? Rav Chaim Shabtai of Salonika lived, obviously in Salonika, from 1557 to 1647, okay, so quite a long life. He seems to have lived his entire life in Salonika. Salonika was, as we know, as I just mentioned, was a very, very significant community in not just in Greece, but in the entire Ottoman Empire. He, I believe, at a certain time became, I don't know if officially or unofficially, was recognized as such as the chief rabbi of the Salonikan Jewish community. He produced many important students and was very highly regarded within the Jewish life of the Ottoman Empire, but clearly beyond that, because he's getting questions from, well, we'll see from, right, originated in Brazil, but we'll see kind of the trajectory or the path that this Shiloh probably took. Now, the last line of the Shiloh part, right, of the question part that was sent to eventually to Rav Chaim Shabtai in Salonika, the last line of the actual inquiry seems to indicate that it wasn't sent directly from Brazil, from Recife to Salonika, which makes a lot of sense. Because when I first saw this, the question I had was, well, why are the Dutch Portuguese Jews living in Brazil, why are they sending their question to Greece, to Salonika? It doesn't make any sense. Naturally, they would send it to Amsterdam. That was the mother country. That was the mothership, if you will, of the Portuguese Portuguese community. It would make just complete logical sense that they would send it to Amsterdam. So why are they sending it? How is it getting to Salonika? So the last line in the Shiloh, in the question itself, seems to indicate that it didn't go directly from Brazil to Salonika, to Rav Chaim Shabtai, but it made a stop somewhere. So it doesn't say this explicitly anywhere, but it makes the most sense that the stop that it made in the middle was in fact Amsterdam. Now, the question that I have not found any sort of, you know, satisfactory answer for, was why didn't the rabbis in Amsterdam just answer this? Why did they send it on to Rav Chaim Shabtai? Why did they send it on to Salonika? Now, you know, in the history of rabbinics, in the history of responsa, so it's common for one rabbi who thinks that either he doesn't have the credentials to answer the severity of a particular question, for that rabbi, excuse me, to send it on to someone else, or if he wants to get some sort of you know, approbation, he wants to get some the agreement of another rabbi to their decision. So then they'll send it on to somebody or to some other people. Usually, you find that in cases of you know, grave halachic severity, cases of agunos, cases similar to that, where the halachic the weight is, there were very weighty topics. The question, which we'll see what it is, we'll finally see what it is very soon, in about a minute or so. It's not the most severe question, so it's unclear why the rabbis in Amsterdam, were not able to answer it themselves. But okay, that's that'll have to remain a question. So we've given a lot of background, right? We've given a lot of background. So now let's begin. Let's get to the actual question and answer. Let's get to the actual responsum. So the question that was posed by the Jews of Recife, eventually got to Rav Chaim Shabtai of Salonika, was, here we are, we've arrived in Recife, and lo and behold, they realize that the seasons are actually different than what they're used to, you know, in the mother country of Holland. That if you look at a map, and they go through some of the geography here in the question, if you look at a map, so Recife finds itself on the lower part, on the southern part of the equator. So, right, go back to elementary school geography. What happens on the southern part of the equator is that the seasons are flipped than what we're used to here in the northern hemisphere. So in the southern hemisphere, when we are in our winter in the north, there, as they are right now, I'm speaking in December, so it's their summer. When we're, it's our summer, it's their winter, etc., etc. So lo and behold, they come to Recife and they realize that the seasons are different. So what do they do in terms of asking for rain and mentioning rain in their Shmona Esrei? We'll spell out and we'll flesh out some of the specifics here and give some of just the halachic, brief halachic background very soon, or just in a moment. But just so we should know, what also makes this tshuva quite significant is that it seems to be, and again, I have to credit Rav Weitman for this wonderful, his wonderful footnotes and his research, but this tshuva seems to be the first of a long, long list of similar tshuvos that were answered in regards to Jewish communities all south of the equator, but we have tshuvos later on in later years that were sent to Australia and that were sent to Argentina and that were sent to Uruguay and just kind of name your southern hemisphere country. There was probably a tshuva sent to them. And there's quite a bit of literature on this topic as to when do Jewish communities in the southern hemisphere, when do they pray for rain? When do they ask for rain? So let's give a little bit of background to the question and to the entire topic. Excuse me. There are two instances in our Shmona Esrei, in our Amida, in which we mention rain. The first one is what's called Hazkaras Gishamim, the mentioning of rain. That's when we say Mashiv HaRuach Umarid HaGeshem in the second bracha of Shmona Esrei. And that's called Haskaras Geshamim. And the other mention of rain is what we call She'elas Geshamim, which is actually asking God for rain. And that is recited in the bracha of Barech Aleinu. So this is actually very timely. Today is December 8th. So here in, in just about everywhere, we'll see about, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, we just a few days ago on December 4th began our She'elas Geshamim saying V'tein Talumatar in Baruch Aleinu. So this is actually very timely. So the Mishnah slash the Gemara and its discussion says that in terms of Haskaras Geshamim, in terms of mentioning Mashiv Haruach Marid HaGeshem, in the second bracha of Shmona Esrei, so that everyone agrees that we say it, we begin saying it on Shmini Atzeres. And that is, in fact, whether you're in Eretz Yisrael, whether you're outside of Eretz Yisrael, in Chutz La'aretz, it doesn't matter, you begin saying it on Shmini Atzeres, and that is in fact, the practice. The Mishnah then and the Gemara then talk about, well, what about She'elas Geshamim? So there's a right asking V'tein Ta'alumatar in the bracha of Baruch Aleinu. So there's a whole there's a machlokas, there's a debate as to when that begins, and basically halachically the conclusion is that in Eretz Yisrael they begin asking for rain, saying V'tein Ta'alumatar on Zayin Mar Cheshvan, on the seventh of the month of Cheshvan, and outside of Eretz Yisrael, it's 60 days after the Tkufa. We are not going to go into how we calculate all of that now. Again, that would take the rest of the shir, but we are, we'll just say that the conclusion is that comes out to this famous date of either December 4th or 5th, depending on the year, in which outside of Eretz Yisrael, we begin asking for rain, which was only, like I said, a few days ago. Okay, so those are the two parts in the Shmona Esrei in which we mention rain. Haskaras Geshamim in the second bracha and the Saint Talumatar in the bracha of Baruch Aleinu. Now, let's go to the actual Shaila, right? So the actual question that was posed by the community in Recife is they presented their facts. Okay, so the facts that they presented were as follows. They said that if it rains during the time that most countries ask for rain, so from, let's say, December 4th until Pesach, now, at least I live in the northeast of the United States, there's no real rainy season, but okay, for argument's sake, we'll call it the rainy season just because that's when we actually ask for rain. We say V'tein Ta'alumatar. So the community in Recife in the 1630s presented and they said, well, if we ask for rain when most other countries in Chutz La'aretz at least are asking for rain from December 4th up until Pesach, right? We finish asking for rain on the first day of Pesach. So they said that would be harmful to our crops. That's not the rainy season here in Brazil. That's actually our summer. And if it rains then, it would actually be harmful. So they therefore thought, and again, this is all presented in the Shaila, in the question, they therefore thought that they should not ask for rain during what's the winter months in the Northern Hemisphere, so they should not ask for rain beginning December 4th and ending on Pesach, but rather they should ask for rain during their winter, which is summer in the Northern Hemisphere, right? So they should ask for rain when we're specifically not asking for rain in the Northern Hemisphere because it's not the rainy season. So it is their rainy season, so they presented in the Shaila in the question that perhaps they should in fact ask for rain then. Yeah, seems logical, right? Seems like a logical conclusion that they themselves came to, again, without any sort of, this is all in the question. Now, it's interesting, again, I said that this question, this Shaila, seems to have made a stop in the middle between from Recife until it reached Salonika to Rav Chaim Shabtai, so it's unclear whether the Jews in Recife came to this seemingly logical conclusion, or whether the rabbis in Amsterdam or wherever the middle stop was reached this conclusion. But it seems like a rather logical conclusion. Now, the question is there any halachic basis for this? So now we get to the tshuva itself. So this is what Rav Chaim Shabtai, this is how Rav Chaim Shabtai approaches this. We're not going to go through the entire tshuva, A, for the sake of time, B, for the sake of clarity. We're not going to go through the entire tshuva, but we'll present some of the main points. So it begins with the opinion of the Rush. The Rush is, of course, Rabbeinu Asher, a 14th century, I believe, 14th century Rishon, very important Rishon, in Germany and then in Spain. The Rush had a very unique approach to this question of She'elas Geshamim, of asking for rain. Again, some might be familiar with this, some not, but we'll present what the Rush's approach was. And the Rush had, and again, this is a seemingly unique approach to this question, but the Rush came to the conclusion that indeed each country should ask for rain based on their own needs. So if you live in a place where the rainy season or the need for rain is in the winter months, so you should ask for rain then. If you live in a place where the rainy season and the need for rain is in the springtime or in the summer, so you should ask for rain then. That was what the Rush concluded. That's what he tried to implement. Why do I say he tried to implement? So interestingly enough, and you'll see here, times don't change, but the Rush, who was the rabbi in his community, said that he tried to implement this change, but the Balabatim, right, his community, did not let him, and they said, this is how we've always done it, Rabbi Rush, right? This is how we've always done it, so with all due respect, we love you, you know, but we're not going to accept your opinion. Okay. The nature of communal politics has never changed, and the Rush tried to implement this this ruling, but he himself says that he was not able to pull it off. Now, the evolution of this approach is that the Tur, right, Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Harush. So the Tur was the son of the Rush. Okay, a very important halachic work. The Tur argued that the Rambam was of the same opinion as the Rush. Okay, so that's what the Tur thought. And again, we're not going to go into the whole discussion that the Tur has from the Rambam, both in his Perush HaMishnayos, as well as the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah. But the Tur argued that the Rambam was actually of the same opinion of the Rush. So this is kind of the background which Rav Chaim Shabtai of Salonika provides for answering this question, and he comes to the conclusion, or comes to a number of conclusions, but he says that he says that he does not believe, Rav Chaim Shabtai does not believe that the Rambam agrees with the Rush. He does not believe that the Rambam felt that every community should ask for rain based on their own needs. However, he says that the opinion of the Rambam is as follows, and there's two elements, essentially, according to Rav Chaim Shabtai. There are two main elements to the Rambam's opinion on this question. Element number one, according to the Rambam, is that one should only ask for rain, again saying v'tein ta'alu matar, during, in barich aleinu, right? You should only ask for rain in barich aleinu. You should only ask for rain, I take that back, you should only ask for rain, you should only do she'elas geshamim during the normal time, after the 7th of Marcheshvan in Eretz Yisrael, or after December 4th, if it is beneficial to you, meaning if you live in a place where asking for rain during the quote-unquote normal time is going to be harmful, then you should not ask for rain then. You should not ask for rain if it's during the normal time, if it's going to be harmful to you. Okay, so that is element number one of Rav Chaim Shabtai's understanding of the Rambam. The second element is that no matter what, he says, according to the Rambam, you may not ever ask for rain in the bracha of Baruch Aleinu, meaning you may never say V'tein Tal U'Matar in its proper place of Baruch Aleinu after Pesach. Never, ever, ever, no matter where you live, you may never ask for rain, say V'tein Tal U'Matar in the bracha of Baruch Aleinu, if it's after Pesach, whether you live in the northern hemisphere, whether you live in the southern hemisphere, whether you live in outer space, it doesn't matter. He says you may never ask for rain then. But rather, he says, if rain is needed in a particular locale during that time, right, after Pesach, if rain is needed in a particular locale, so you can't say it in Baruch Aleinu, but you can say it in the bracha of Shomea Tefillah, right? You can insert it in the bracha of Shomea Tefillah. Therefore, Rav Chaim Shabtai says, like we just explained, that the community in Recife, they're in the southern hemisphere, the community in Recife, they should definitely not ask for rain in Baruch Aleinu after Pesach. He just concluded that according to the Rambam, that is a complete no-no, never allowed to do that, even though it is their winter, but rather they should say it in Shomea Tefillah. So he concludes that the community in Recife, because their seasons are flipped from what we're familiar with in the northern hemisphere, so therefore they should in fact say V'tein Tal U'Matar during their winter, i.e. during our summer, but they should say it in Shomea Tefillah, right? So that corresponds to the second point that we just said in the Rambam. Since it's after Pesach, they're not permitted to say it in the bracha of Baruch Aleinu, but since it's needed for them, so then they should say it in Shomea Tefillah. The second part of Rav Chaim Shabtai's conclusion is that during their summer, meaning when it's not their rainy season, during their summer, so even though it's our winter, again, sorry to confuse you, you got to keep track here, but during their summer, when it's our winter and we in the northern hemisphere are in fact saying She'elas Geshamim, we are saying V'tein Tal U'Matar, but during their summer, since it's going to be harmful to them if it rains then they should not ask for rain at all. Rather, they should say V'tein Bracha. Right? So again, the conclusion that Rav Chaim Shabtai reaches, again, just to reiterate, is that the community in Recife that's asking this question in the southern hemisphere is that they should, during their rainy season, which is our summer, they should recite V'tein Tal U'Matar, but not in its regular location of the bracha of Baruch Aleinu, but rather in the bracha of Shomea Tefillah as a special insertion. And during their summer, which is our winter, when we in the northern hemisphere are asking for rain, but since rain during that time would be harmful to them, so therefore they should refrain from asking at that point for asking for rain. And they should continue saying, V'tein Bracha at that point in time. So what emerges actually interesting is that seemingly that the community in Recife, and again, this is one of a number of approaches, as I mentioned at the beginning, this is the first tshuva that addresses this question, but there is quite an extensive literature, again, to many different communities later on, so not going to go through every single approach, but what emerges from Rav Chaim Shabtai's approach is that the community in Recife would never say V'tein Tal U'Matar in Baruch Aleinu, right? In Baruch Aleinu, they would say V'tein Bracha the entire year, 365 days a year, they would say V'tein Bracha, and they would only say V'tein Tal U'Matar in Shomea Tefillah during their rainy season. Now, all of that was based on Rav Chaim Shabtai's understanding of the Rambam. The Rav Chaim Shabtai then makes an interesting point. He says that his opinion, he believes that his opinion even aligns with the Rush. The question is, how can that be? Didn't the Rush think that one should ask for rain whenever it is beneficial to them? So according to the Rush, you would say, right? According to the Rush, presumably you would say, v'tein talu matar in barech aleinu, whenever it's beneficial to them. So if you take the Rush, if we were to take the initial understanding of the Rush at face value, so the Rush would argue that in Recife, they should say v'tein talu matar in barech aleinu, during their rainy season. Who cares what they're doing in the northern hemisphere, right? That seemingly would be what the Rush would answer. However, Rav Chaim Shabtai has a very interesting understanding of the Rush, and he says that his position even aligns with the Rush. So how can that be? So he explains as follow. Rav Chaim Shabtai explains that the Rush thought, okay, that the Rush makes an important distinction according to Rav Chaim Shabtai. He says that the Rush thought that only if an entire country needs rain at a particular season should they ask for it then. But if it's only one community or one city, even if it's a large city that needs rain at a particular season, they do not have permission to ask for rain in Barech Aleinu then, right? So the Rush, according to Rav Chaim Shabtai, the Rush has this distinction between an entire country and a one community or one city even. And he says, therefore, since the Jews in Recife were only one community, even the Rush, argues Rav Chaim Shabtai, even the Rush would agree that they cannot ask in Baruch Aleinu during their rainy season, but should rather ask in Shomea Tefillah. And his he sees, he's medayek, right? He's very exacting and specific in the words of the Rush, where he says that the Rush seems to indicate, I believe he says the Rush uses this term, Eretz, right? If an entire land requires rain at a particular time, then they should ask it at the particular time. But he says only if it's an entire Eretz, if it's an entire land or country, but not a particular city. So that's how Reb Chaim Shabtai explains how he believes that even the Rush would agree with his conclusion. So again, just to review, and we'll wrap up here, but Rav Chaim Shabtai's conclusion, again, just to reiterate, is that during their winter in the southern hemisphere, so the Jews of Recife should ask for rain in Shomea Tefillah, not in the normal place of Baruch Aleinu. And during their summer months, they should not ask for rain at all, even though the northern hemisphere is doing so. Why should they not ask for rain? Because since it would be harmful for them at that time, they do not have permission, right? Don't have permission. It's wrong to ask for rain when it would be harmful to them. So again, what emerges is just an interesting little tidbit is that they would end up saying v'tein bracha an entire year and never, in fact, say v'tein talu matar in the bracha of Baruch Aleinu, but just during Shomea Tefillah during their rainy season. So just to wrap this up, is that, like we mentioned, is that the significance of this tshuva, is that, number one, it's the first halachic inquiry on this very question of when to ask for rain, when to have she'elas geshamim, in the southern hemisphere. As we said, this became much more common as Jews began settling in other places in the southern hemisphere, be it South America, be it Australia, New Zealand, etc. So you begin getting poskim who address this question more extensively. And the second significant point of this tshuva is maybe kind of obvious, but it's the first contact. It's the first contact between Jews in the Americas and halachic authorities, right? I mentioned this collection that Rav Weitman put together of the writings of Rav Yitzchak Abuhav, the first rabbi in the Americas, and if you look through his writings, Rav Yitzchak Abuhav calls America, he's in Brazil, he's in Recife, but he calls Brazil this dark place at the ends of the earth, right? It was complete and utter exile from his homeland, if you will. I'm not even talking about Eretz Yisrael, but his homeland, if you will, quote unquote, of Amsterdam and of Holland. I mean, Brazil, America was the other end of the earth, right? Europeans probably didn't even know about it until a little bit before this was written. So this is the first contact between Jews in the Americas and halachic authorities. It establishes the Americas as a destination for halachic literature. There's not much from the period until we hit about the 19th century, but as we'll see in this series, there was in fact contact, there were shilos, there were questions that were addressed and that were sent to various communities around the Americas. And it's an important piece of literature. Also from a historical point of view, it's an important piece of literature from the short-lived community in Recife. So there's some literature. There's some literature from that community, and this certainly is an important portion of that literature in terms of giving us a little bit of a perspective as to what was the community like. They cared about these issues. They cared about halacha. Right, they sent their question overseas because it was important enough to them. And again, it gives us a little bit of insight into what the community was like and is an important piece of literature from that time period. Thank you.